Recording. Okay, we're going to start recording. So I'm doing my best starting class voice. Everybody sit down, get your pens out, start taking notes, all right? There will be a quiz. Welcome to session 336, Will, Grace, and Angels in Brokeback America, Straight Women, Gay Men, and Mormonism. Please, please, please turn off your cell phones. Other people are very nice, and they say, please turn off your cell phones and noisemakers, and they offer no punishment, whereas if your cell phone rings during my session, I will track you down later, jab you really hard in the arm, and say, shame on you. So please, turn your cell phone off. Okay. I'm Holly Welker. If you want to know anything about my credentials and bio, talk to me later. All right. I have noticed that sessions at Sunstone discussing homosexuality tend to focus on male homosexuality, and the discussants, regardless of orientation, are generally male. I propose this panel in part as a way of calling attention to the fact that homosexuality is an issue that also affects women. Admittedly, this panel does not include lesbian voices, but it seemed artificial to ask a lesbian to comment on this topic just as a way of correcting previous imbalances. I hope future sessions will address the concerns of lesbians or at least include their voices. It's been 25 years since I first read Plato's Symposium in college, but I remember the discussion in my Western Civ class of Athenian society, its marriage laws and customs. All citizens who were exclusively male, women could not be citizens but were instead virtually slaves, were expected to marry and sire children, preferably sons. In this discussion, we did not omit the reference to the unspeakable vice of the Greeks, as boys in British schools were once instructed to do, but instead talked frankly about the flirtation between Socrates and Alcibiades and considered what it meant for a homosocial, homosexual, patriarchal, misogynist society to require men to marry and require men to marry women and impregnate them as part of their duties as members of the community. What does it mean for a homophobic, patriarchal, misogynist society to require men to marry women and impregnate them as part of their duties as members of the community? In Judges 19, we get the story of a Levite whose concubine leaves him to return to her parents' home, an activity labeled playing the whore against him. The Levite retrieves his concubine. On the way home, they stop in Gibeah, where the men are Benjaminites, meaning that they are of the tribe of Benjamin and that they have sex with other men. The Levite sets up camp in a city street only to be implored by an old man not to lodge there. Instead, the stranger offers the couple shelter for the night. In verse 22, we read, "Now as they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, certain sons of Belial, beset the house round about and beat at the door and spake to the master of the house, the old man, saying, Bring forth the man that came into thine house, that we may know him." Remember, it's the Bible. "And the man, the master of the house, went out unto them, Nay, my brethren, nay, I pray you, do not so wickedly. Seeing that this man is come into mine house, do not this folly. Behold, here is my daughter, a maiden, and his concubine. Them I will bring out now, and humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you. But unto this man do not so vile a thing." But the men would not hearken to him. So the man took his concubine and brought her forth unto them, and they knew her and abused her all the night long until the morning, and when the day began to spring, they let her go. Then came the woman in the dawning of the day and fell down at the door of the man's house where her lord was, till it was light. And the lord rose up in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way. And behold, the woman, his concubine, was fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. And he said unto her, as one does to one's concubine when she's been gang raped, Up and let us be going. But none answered. Then the man took her upon an ass, and the man rose up and gat him unto his place. And when he was come into his house, he took a knife and laid hold on his concubine and divided her together with her bones into 12 pieces and sent her into all the coasts of Israel. Cutting an ox into 12 parts and sending a piece to each of the tribes was a call to war. But why slice up a perfectly good ox when you've already got a dead concubine? Keep in mind, the Levite called the tribes to war because his property had been destroyed. Had the woman survived the gang rape, there would have been no war. The tale is revolting in its homophobia, its misogyny, its unspeakable violence. It shows that homosexual acts are so abominable that to prevent their occurrence, one should offer one's virgin daughter to be humbled, because in these matters, women's health and happiness, if not their very lives, are acceptable sacrifices. Gay gang rape is unthinkable, but straight gang rape? Hey, if it placates the horny male miscreants outside your door, no problem. In the aftermath, the other 11 tribes nearly destroy Benjamin. Only 600 of its men remain when the battle ends. It looks as though the tribe will die out, for the men in the other tribes have sworn not to give their daughters in marriage to Benjamin, an oath they can't renounce. But they don't want to be the 11 tribes of Israel, so they hatch a plan to provide the Benjaminites with wives. A group of virgins will be celebrating a feast in a vineyard, and if the Benjaminites ride in, kidnap the virgins, and marry them, well, their fathers haven't broken their oaths because they haven't given their daughters in marriage to Benjamin, only allowed them to be taken. Marriage and procreation, you see, were both duties and rights of these men, regardless of sexual conduct they engaged in with other men. The important thing was to keep the tribe going. This is the spiritual and moral legacy we have inherited. Some claim that fulfilling this duty should remain a right all men, gay or straight, are entitled to. Last week, the New York Times ran an article entitled, "When the Beard is Too Painful to Remove," which notes that, for gay men in heterosexual marriages, even after the status quo becomes unbearable, the pull of domestic life remains powerful. Many are desperate to preserve their marriages, to continue reaping the emotional and financial support of wives, and domestic pleasures like tucking children in at night, benefits they hope to retain either by lying, promising their wives they will not have sex with other men, or persuading the wives to accept their double lives. An example of the middle category, swearing fidelity, is described in Ben Christensen's essay, Getting Out, from the fall 2005 issue of Dialogue. Christensen, a gay man in his mid-20s with a wife and two children, argues that the whole point of the civil rights and women's liberation movements was to allow blacks, women, and other minorities to break free of what had been their traditional roles. We live in a world where it's okay for blacks to do what was once considered white and for women to do what was once considered male, get an education, have a career, etc. Why then is it not politically correct for a gay man to venture into what is usually considered the exclusive territory of straight men, to marry a woman and have a family if that's what he chooses to do? I confess I am horrified by this passage, by the sense of entitlement it expresses, its smug ignorance and naivete. Can he really believe that the whole point of the civil rights and women's liberation movement was to allow blacks, women, and other minorities to break free of what had been their traditional roles? Let's not forget that that was not the whole point of those movements. An important goal of the civil rights movement was to pass and enforce legislation that would remove the threat of violence blacks so often lived under. It was not simply about securing a genuine opportunity to vote or to go to school or keeping a seat on the bus. It was about living without fear of being lynched and murdered. The same goes for the feminist movement. There has been a long struggle to compel lawmakers and enforcement agencies to treat sexual and domestic violence as the crimes they should be, and to give women such originally rare privileges as the right to retain property and a legal identity after marriage, or to sue an abusive husband for divorce. Let's also not forget the role violence has played in the gay rights movement. It's not all about securing insurance for your same-sex partner or the right to adopt. It's also about living without the threat of being imprisoned and sentenced to hard labor for the crime of sodomy, like Oscar Wilde, or tied to a fence and left to die, like Matthew Shepard, a crime perpetrated, remember, by young men raised Mormon. As for the question about why isn't it politically correct for a gay man to venture into the exclusive territory of straight men, to marry a woman and have a family if that's what he chooses to do, well, I could cite not only ancient Athenian and Hebrew society, but marriages like Oscar Wilde's and Cole Porter's, all of which involved men who engaged in homosexual activity, marrying women who did not, to support my contention that Christensen's basic assumption is flawed. As it happens, I am all for opening what has been the exclusive territory of straight men to marry a woman and have a family to gay women. But Christensen shows little care for the rights and opportunities of women, gay or straight. His concern is with preserving the privileges of men, straight or gay. Thus remains a question needing an answer, which is why I rephrased it earlier. What does it mean for a homophobic, patriarchal, misogynist society to require men to marry women and impregnate them as part of their duties as members of the community? Why should a gay Mormon man give a damn about women's sexuality, since doctrine created by straight Mormon men doesn't? Consider DNC 132, a man can have an infinite number of wives, who belong to him, but no more than one man can belong to a woman, because women are given to men to multiply and replenish the earth. Women's pleasure and subjectivity aren't factors. Does American culture even care about women's sexuality unless it's used for men's pleasure? A recent article in Salon discussed straight high school and college girls who make out with other straight women at parties as performance for guys, either for material gain like free entry or alcohol, or to advertise that they're sexually open and adventurous. The article states that, in the case of females who get it on solely for male enjoyment, it's not at all about experimenting with females. The motivations aren't about your own desires, they're about getting guys excited and looking hot. It's ironic because they're engaging in sexual behavior, which is supposed to look like it's about sexual desire. The crucial part of it is that they make sure no one thinks they're actually lesbians. And this has to do with the prevalence of porn directed at straight men, which is primarily girl-on-girl action. Well, not primarily, but frequently girl-on-girl action. I had a whole thing, but there's not time. Okay. Sexuality, even female sexuality, is predominantly male-centric, and women are often blamed when men find sex unsatisfying. For instance, in Confessions of a Mormon Boy, Stephen Fales relates how he handled the prospect of divorce when, after 6 years of marriage, his same-sex attraction finally put too great a strain on the marriage. I turned it all on my wife. It was her fault. She never wore lingerie. I bet she never wore lingerie. I wonder what she wore instead. She wouldn't watch the better sex videos I ordered from the back of GQ. She knew going into this marriage it might come to this, and now that I finally cracked, she's going to just throw me out? She had failed me. In a move straight from Genesis, Fales abdicates responsibility for his own actions and blames the woman. She failed to beguile me, so I did seek other fruit. The hope is that, as in Genesis, the prime patriarch will collude with the lesser patriarch and assign principal guilt to the woman, who will be punished for her sins with further suffering and less agency. Fales later acknowledges that, of course, his wife was not responsible for his homosexuality or the failure of their marriage. But that didn't stop him from blaming her in the first place. And even when women are not blamed, their suffering and unhappiness often goes unrecognized or undervalued. In commentary accompanying Christensen's essay in Dialogue, Ron Scow quotes a Mormon man who spent 8 years in a temple marriage. It was only after I came out to my wife that I realized how much she had suffered and endured over the years in asking questions like, why didn't I find her desirable, or why our sexual relation never seemed satisfying? Was it a failure on her part, she wondered. She had sadness about feeling alone, confused, and hurt in ways that were nearly impossible to articulate. Having left the church myself, which is often a part of coming out of the closet, and having watched a score of Mormon men come out, I know the trauma can be excruciating. But let's consider the other side of the equation as well. How self-obsessed and blind do you have to be to live with someone 8 years and not notice that you're making her miserable and isolated? Scow continues, the young man emphasized the falsity of a prevalent myth. I saw my struggle with and against homosexuality as my own cross to bear. I felt I was the one who was suffering, struggling, trying to make things right. What I failed to recognize was that my wife was also part of the struggle, even though she lacked basic information. I don't want to minimize or ignore the cruel and vicious ways in which the church victimizes gay men. But I also don't want to minimize or ignore the cruel and vicious ways in which men who uphold and benefit from patriarchy, and as long as men wield the priesthood in the Mormon church, they do benefit from patriarchy, even when they're gay, victimize women, not only politically but personally, inside the relationships, inside the arena of relationships and sex. I know it can take a while to figure out one's sexual identity, and that people who avoid sexual behavior during their teens, only to marry in their early 20s, might not have a firm handle on their sexual orientation. I've known people who figure out after a decade or two of marriage that maybe they're not straight after all. I know from watching friends go through it that it's profoundly painful. But I also think from observing various marriages and divorces that there's something different happening when men who know ahead of time they are gay court and marry women they know are straight. Whether or not these men are seeking some kind of cure, they still seek to assuage their own suffering and discomfort through means that create profound suffering and discomfort for women, suffering and discomfort women have been trained to believe they should accept. I submit that patriarchy endows men with a sense of entitlement. Witness Christensen's resentment that marrying women and fathering children is still the exclusive territory of straight men, that blinds them to the real cost of their actions, whereas women are trained through doctrines like the New and Everlasting Covenant to expect that they will not have the exclusive regard or affection of their husbands, that indeed their feelings about their marriages are less important than the patriarch's wielding of authority. Both Fales and Christensen stress that they informed their wives of their homosexuality before the wedding. They didn't make this revelation at the start of the courtship. They waited until marriage had been discussed. The real time to make this admission is before the first date, before the woman is in love and has a vision of her married future. Admitting to a serious girlfriend that one is gay ends the deception, but I doubt it improves the chances for success of any subsequent marriage, given how naively and earnestly hopeful Mormon women are about marriage and how ignorant they are about sex if they've obeyed the law of chastity. So what do we do instead? How do gay men and straight women share the same planet, if not the same bed? While I don't advocate marriage between gay men and straight women, I do think they have much to offer each other in terms of friendship, hence the invocation of Will and Grace in the title of the panel. What happens when gay men and straight women try to be friends? Virginia Woolf addresses this in a memoir entitled Old Bloomsbury. She writes, and I realize this is anachronistic, I hope it's not offensive, she was being hip, okay? The society of buggers has many advantages if you are a woman. It is simple, it is honest, it makes one feel, in some respects, at one's ease. But it has this drawback. With buggers, one cannot, as nurses say, show off. Something is always suppressed, held down. Wolf arrives at this conclusion after trying to puzzle out why certain of her brother Toby's university classmates who would visit the home she kept with Toby and their sister Vanessa were simultaneously brilliant and boring, gifted and barren, why certain young men made one feel that one could not honestly be anything. The answer to all my questions was, obviously, as you will have guessed, that there was no sexual attraction between us. Although this lack of physical attraction makes certain things impossible, it makes other things possible. Learning to accept, not merely tolerate, the sexuality of others allows Wolf to embrace and experience the world more fully. Wolf relates an anecdote involving a visit from Lytton Strachey, who once proposed marriage to her only to withdraw his offer when it occurred to him that if he married her, he might have to kiss her. Wolf had been arguing with her brother-in-law, Clive Bell, while Clive's wife, Vanessa, sat on the couch sewing. Suddenly the door opened and the long and sinister figure of Mr. Lytton Strachey stood on the threshold. He pointed his finger at a stain on Vanessa's white dress. "Semen," he said. "Can one really say it?" I thought, and we burst out laughing. With that one word, all barriers of reticence and reserve went down. A flood of the sacred fluid seemed to overwhelm us. Sex permeated our conversation. The word bugger was never far from our lips. Wolf declares that as a result of this, of being able to discuss these topics openly, the whole aspect of life was changed, adding that there was now nothing that one could not say, nothing that one could not do at our home. It was not, I think, a great advance in civilization. It may be true that the loves of buggers are not, at least if one is of the other persuasion, of enthralling interest or paramount importance. But the fact that they can be mentioned openly leads to the fact that no one minds if they are practiced privately. I admit I am a very big fan of the society of buggers, as Wolf terms it, which is good since I've always attracted it. My boyfriend from kindergarten, my date to the prom, and my ex-fiancé are all gay RMs. Then there is my best friend, Save Your Own Asses. That's his online name. Think about that for a minute, Save Your Own Asses. Who grew up gay and Mormon but never served a mission. Understanding their lives and their sexuality has enriched my own. Over Christmas, I went to see Brokeback Mountain with Save Your Own Asses while we were home for the holidays. I stayed with my sister, who is both a dutiful Mormon who avoids R-rated movies and a devoted and knowledgeable fan of fine film. She knew she wouldn't see the movie but wanted to hear about it. "Is it really as good as they say?" she asked. "It really is," I said. "Heath Ledger deserves the Oscar." He was robbed. He reminds me of some of our cousins. He does a thoroughly convincing job of playing a taciturn cowboy. "I hear both characters have wives," she said. "Yes," I responded. "That's one thing I liked about the movie. All the characters are treated with dignity and respect. The wives aren't the focus of the movie, but they're not neglected. The situation does incredible damage to the women, but they're not shown as acceptable casualties." "Well," my sister said emphatically, pots banging as she emptied her dishwasher. "It's great that they portray it well, but the situation itself is not okay. These guys have got to stop marrying women." "You looking for an argument?" I ask. "I was engaged to a gay man, remember? I don't think gay men should marry straight women either." "They've got to stop," she repeated. "They've got to stop hiding behind wives. It's not fair to use women like that." "I couldn't agree more," I said, "and it's a time-honored practice with a name, in case you didn't know. Marrying someone of the opposite sex for the purpose of passing for normal in straight society is called having a beard. And I think gay men should be metaphorically, if not literally, clean-shaven. But I also think that if you want gay men to stop marrying straight women, one good way of helping that happen is to let them marry each other. She made no reply to that. As a Mormon Republican, what could she say? But she at least nodded. I know the gay community is divided on the issue of marriage. Many believe heterosexual marriage is an inherently flawed and repressive institution, one that lesbians and gay men would be better off not emulating, since what's needed is a transformation of all romantic and sexual partnerships into something more respectful and equal. I respect that view, but until we achieve that transformation, I feel that if consenting adults want to marry same-sex partners, they should have the legal right to do so, even if they don't take advantage of that right. I also feel that it is in the best interest of straight women, especially straight Mormon women, to be advocates of gay rights. It's one of those easy situations where the ethical thing to do is also conveniently self-serving. I don't know if it's necessarily in the best interest of gay men to be advocates of women's rights, but I know so many gay men who sincerely and devotedly espouse the cause of feminism. Their own experiences with oppression have taught them something about what it's like to be a woman in this culture, and they want to make life easier for their sisters, mothers, and in some cases, daughters and ex-wives. As one of my male friends put it, a form of liberation of one group of people, gay men, which, remember, accounts for about 10% of the population, that ignores the consequences of their actions on other groups, including women, 50% of the population, does not amount to a liberation at all. Instead, it raises the question of whether, in the defense of such generalized form of privilege, patriarch doesn't, in fact, attempt to transform the political demands of gay men into demands that, in the end, provide support for the patriarchy and other forms of hierarchy and privilege. That's hegemony at work. As for my own story, I did not marry a gay man, but I was engaged to one in 1988 when we fell in love at first sight. The story has a reasonably happy ending. He had enough integrity and wisdom that he could not permit himself to marry me, knowing that however much he loved me, he would never lose his attraction to men. But it took 4 years of my wheedling and prodding and begging to extract that confession from him. Before that, he kept insisting that his refusal to marry me had nothing to do with sexual orientation, that it was because I wasn't the right woman for him. Given how I loved him, the whole thing was torture. I doubted his heterosexuality, even though there was a time we could hardly keep our hands off each other. That was one reason it seemed sensible to make wedding plans. I know I loved him body and soul and will love him till I die, if not beyond that. I know that after he ended the relationship, I was utterly bereft, thoroughly heartbroken, absolutely devastated. I couldn't imagine life without him. Not only that, but I felt profoundly isolated and was convinced all men are gay, or at least homosocial. I saw so little evidence of genuine respect among men for women that it was hard to believe men could actually desire these creatures they showed such contempt for. At some point, I realized there are lots of straight men in the world, and that it's very possible to be sexually aroused by someone you find contemptible. That, in fact, certain sexual activities are deliberate expressions of contempt, calling someone a filthy whore and raping her, for instance. But I also learned that sex can be magnificent with the right person. I was going to extrapolate on that, but you either know or don't, so, you know. My gay ex-fiancé and I are still close friends, by the way, 18 years after we first met and fell in love. His admission that he was gay was a genuine gift because it allowed me to stop hoping and get on with my life, and I believe it's one reason we are still so devoted. It hasn't always been easy, but it's been worth it. He's been with his current partner for over 10 years. They live in Brussels, and I visited there a couple of times. They have a daughter conceived through artificial insemination. Her mother is a lesbian friend of theirs, and she and her partner have primary custody of the child. It's a good family. In his commentary to Christensen's essay, Scow notes that Christensen oversimplifies his options as either temple marriage or a rampant life of unrestrained queerness. Obviously, Scow points out, there are many choices between the two extremes. Christensen ends his essay by relating an epiphany that occurs after a BYU fireside where they tell you to get married. I'd pretty much tuned out the entire thing, he writes, because it didn't apply to me. But then I got home, sat on my bed, and had a distinct impression that yes, it did apply to me. Yes, I was gay, but that didn't mean I was excluded from Heavenly Father's desire for his children to marry and have families. I am glad Christensen had that epiphany. I accept its truthfulness. What I don't accept is his oversimplified and religiously predetermined interpretation that any marriage he might have must be with a woman for whom he feels little sexual desire. While I acknowledge the right he and his wife have to do as they please, I have the right to find their efforts destructive and ill-advised rather than admirable. And I say that in reference to an article in the Tribune last week about how spiffy it was, you know. Why should he settle for a partner he doesn't desire? Why should his wife settle for a partner who doesn't truly desire her? The fact that they're willing to do it doesn't strike me as adequate justification. I want for these gay men who marry straight women what they seem unable to want for themselves or their wives, to be able to form their families and raise their children with a partner beloved, cherished, and desired, body and soul, and I think the world will be a better place for me and all other straight women and men when gay women and men have that right. Thank you. Our next speaker is going to be Emily Pearson, who is an accomplished actress. Do you have a longer bio you want to give me?
You said two lines.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Sorry. They moved me out of my room. I'm really confused. All right. Emily Pearson is an accomplished actress, a published author with a memoir currently in production, co-founder of Wildflowers, a support network for women currently or formerly married to gay men, and a single mother of two children. And she will be our next speaker.
Okay, I'll tell you right now what I wore to bed. It was this underwear that went from here to here. The hardest thing for me about being required to read my talk is that I have to pretend that I'm not getting older. I mean, I can't pretend that I'm not getting older because I have to put these on and I don't like to do that, but so, okay. Okay, for any of you here that have actually never heard of Goodbye, I Love You, or Confessions of a Mormon Boy, I will briefly introduce myself. My name is Emily Pearson. I am the daughter of a homosexual man named Gerald Pearson, who died of AIDS when I was 16 years old. My mother, Carolyn Pearson, wrote a book entitled Goodbye, I Love You, that was published in 1986, chronicling their courtship, marriage, divorce, and his subsequent death. Roughly 9 years later, I was sealed for time and all eternity by the exact same temple sealer, in the exact same temple that my parents had been sealed in, to a man that I consciously knew was a homosexual. I'm here today to answer the burning question that everybody on the planet keeps asking me, and that is, what were you thinking? The answer to that question is simply that I wasn't. I wasn't thinking. It's not that I didn't love Stephen. I did. I cared deeply for him, and at the time of our wedding, we were very loving, very dear friends. But initially, when I learned that my fiancé had a history with homosexuality, I was far more interested in being faithful, obedient, and righteous than I was in learning from my family history, my own personal history, and in using my own mind and best judgment to make life-altering decisions. I was about 12 years old when I first consciously acknowledged that my father, whom I adored, was gay. It was also around that time that I stopped passing notes to my friends in sacrament meeting and daydreaming in Sunday school and started actually hearing what my Heavenly Father, whom I also adored, had to say about my dad. I was devastated to learn that he was, among other things, evil, putrid, perverse, sinful, better off dead, should have a millstone put around his neck and drowned in the ocean, and my personal favorite, someone that had succumbed to Satan, who is himself a homosexual. There are people that go to church, seminary, gospel doctrine, youth conference, religion or institute classes, and upon hearing something that is either questionable or downright ludicrous, are able to let it roll right off their backs and clearly recognize it for what it is. I was not one of those people. I swallowed whole everything I was fed and digested all of it. I took everything I was taught literally and seriously and built my entire existence around it. At church, I was never taught specifically to not think, but I was taught to have unwavering faith and unquestioning devotion to the Lord and the leaders of his church. I believed that if you couldn't just suck it up and have faith, what good were you? Yes, I was entitled to personal revelation, but I knew that if I prayed and got an answer that didn't jive with the Lord's teachings, then I was to get back on my knees until I got the right answer. Austin L. Sorenson said, "A child is not likely to find a father in God unless he finds something of God in his father." My relationship and experience with Gerald, my earthly father, had a direct influence on my relationship with my heavenly father. As a child, I didn't know the terms codependent or narcissistic personality disorder. I just knew that my dad and I had an exceptionally close and special relationship. I also knew that if I crossed him, didn't agree with him, or stood as my own person, that relationship ran the risk of changing drastically. While I was taught that Heavenly Father's love for me was unconditional, deep down I never really believed it. I was convinced that if I didn't do everything perfectly, keep every commandment, and agree with everything said over the pulpit, then my Heavenly Father could also very easily stop loving me. I believed the words of the song sung in church, "Teach me all that I must do to live with him someday." It's just that there were so many things I had to do to be able to live with God again one day. I had to be baptized, endowed in the temple, married there for time and all eternity, pay tithing, read my scriptures, pray daily, attend all my church meetings, stay away from tobacco and alcohol, stay morally clean. The list went on and made Heavenly Father's love seem very conditional indeed. It was bizarre trying to juggle my different lives. I hung out with my dad and the half-naked Castro Street drag queens on Saturday, and with my mom and the correctly clothed, righteous descendants of Mormon pioneers on Sunday. The Mormon church, which was the same thing to me as my Heavenly Father, apparently hated my dad, and my dad in turn hated the church, thus my Heavenly Father. I loved both my fathers desperately, but doing so would eventually cause either or both of them to reject and stop loving me. Clearly, I wasn't lovable for just being me. There were too many things I had to do and do perfectly. For my Heavenly Father's love, I had to be pure and righteous and obedient and believe everything I was taught. For my biological father's love, I had to erase myself for him and again believe and do everything he wanted me to. I had to be perfect in a way I knew I would never be able to be. I couldn't please or be loved by both fathers. It simply wasn't possible. I had to choose. And of course, I chose Gerald. He was immediate, tangible, and bigger and louder to me than even God himself. Even though it broke me in half, I chose him over everything, God, the church, my mom, even myself. Several years later, after my dad's death, I worked hard at realigning my heart with the Mormon church. It was a very mixed experience. I felt safe there, but the old confusion came back too. Now that my dad was dead, would I really never see him again? After all, he was the vilest of sinners who had lost his life due to his evil behavior. I learned at church that if I worked hard and could actually make it to the celestial kingdom, I could possibly get a sort of day pass to visit him. That was far better than eternal separation, so if an issue arose at church that didn't feel right, I would not allow myself to think about it. In fact, that became sort of a mantra for me. Don't think about it, don't think about it, don't think about it, don't think about it. The guilt that I felt about having not chosen God over my dad was crushing. I vowed to my Heavenly Father and to myself that I would never again put anything above God, nor would I be anything but 100% faithful and obedient. So years and what felt like several lifetimes later, when the man I had decided to marry told me that he had a history of same-sex attraction, I was devastated. It was pretty much the same story Gerald and so many of my other friends had told. Questions before mission, brief experience after, freak out, and confession to Bishop. Only Stephen's experience didn't end there. He had become a healed and fervent believer in reparative therapy, which was something that I had actually never heard of. He explained to me that male homosexuality is basically the result of having an overbearing mother and a weak or emotionally absent father, and that once those issues are fully addressed and worked through, the so-called homosexual in question will find himself transformed into a full-blown heterosexual. I had long talks with God about that one. Reparative therapy, could such a thing really work? Was that the answer I'd been looking for all along? Was it that maybe my dad just hadn't had the right therapy? No, I knew better than that. I had been on Geraldo and Regis and Kathy Lee for crying out loud. I knew exactly how it would turn out. Stephen, however, believed that reparative therapy worked. And he believed that with my love, support, and understanding of all the complexities of it all, he could absolutely do it, no question. I began to think that maybe God's plan for us was far bigger than Stephen and I just getting married. Maybe together we had a greater than us work to do. Maybe we could marry and actually be successful at it. We could write a book together, a far different book than the one my mother wrote. Our book would show how we conquered successfully what the previous generation had failed miserably at. Stephen and I could be the poster children for reparative therapy. And according to the books on reparative therapy and what we were taught in church, Stephen wasn't really gay at all. He was just experiencing some gender confusion due to issues with his parents and extreme opposition from Satan. I did believe that with God, all things were possible. Slowly, it began making perfect sense to me. It was probably part of the plan, part of my life's mission from the very beginning. And I had already had the confirmations, both in my heart and in hands-on-head priesthood blessings, that Stephen had been provided for me. I was not about to disobey God again, no matter what. So I closed my eyes and allowed myself to be swept into the middle of something I felt was bigger than myself, something that was beyond my control, and something from which there was absolutely no turning back. On December 15, 1993, Stephen and I entered the Salt Lake Temple to be married as husband and wife for time and all eternity. I was sick all morning. Outwardly, I was ever the beaming and gracious bride. Inwardly, I was melting. The weight of what Stephen and I were undertaking suddenly felt unbearably heavy. It was my job to keep him straight for the rest of our lives, and I was terrified. A good friend of my dad's in college, when he was engaged in dealing with homosexuality, had gone with his fiancée to speak to a general authority. The man who would one day become the prophet of the church had looked the fiancée in the eyes and said, "If you are sufficiently feminine, you can save this man." At least I knew better than that. I knew that it wasn't a matter of my being woman enough to do it. I knew that our success would have little to do with my femininity. It would have everything to do with my faith, our faith. This was our Abrahamic sacrifice. I couldn't help wondering if maybe God would send an angel to save us at the last minute too, but he didn't. For 6.5 years, we struggled to make it work, but the pressures of grad school, poverty, isolation in the backwoods of Connecticut, babies, morning sickness, depression, a lack of mutual emotional support, and the elephant we lived with, whose presence we did not acknowledge and whose name we would not speak, took too great a toll on the friendship we had started out with. When Stephen let me know that the pressure cooker that he had been living in finally blew up, I knew the marriage was over. My parents had dragged their marriage out for 4 long and painful years after my mother learned of my father's active homosexual life. I was unwilling to do the same. I knew we could fast and pray and struggle and fight and work for years, but without question, we would eventually end up divorced. I no longer believed that God had called us to do an amazing work together, and I no longer believed that anything could heal or change homosexuality. We had attempted the impossible, and we had failed. A few years after the divorce, my boyfriend introduced me to Julie Cruz, a woman who had also been married to a gay man. Together, we decided to form a support group for women currently or formerly married to gay men. We called our group Wildflowers, in honor of my father, who had been cremated, mixed with wildflower seeds, and spread in a meadow on top of Mount Tamalpais overlooking San Francisco. To date, the majority of our members are LDS, and there are many active discussions about the role the church has played in our marriages. And that role is huge. My guess is that most of us Latter-day Saints grow up thinking that if we just pay our tithing, read our scriptures, and remain temple-worthy, everything in our lives will beautifully fall into place. Eventually, we all learn that life doesn't necessarily work that way. For anyone, that's a bitter pill to swallow. For a woman who was counseled by her church leaders to marry a gay man and told that everything would be just fine, the disillusionment of having it all blow up in her face can be paralyzing. She feels used, tricked, furious, and incredibly stupid. One woman in our group consoled another by saying, "We were naive because we trusted. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what we were taught as Maya Maids and Laurels. We didn't know any better. We weren't stupid. We just did what we did because we trusted." Fortunately, I believe the Mormon Church is making a few good strides and at least not pushing mixed orientation marriages as an answer to the homosexual problem the way it used to. But it still has a long way to go in dealing with the complexities of the issue, or sometimes in dealing with it at all. One woman, upon learning of her fiancé's homosexuality, wrote to 2 members of the Quorum of the Twelve. One wrote her back, berating her for wasting the precious time of someone of his stature, and the other had his assistant send her a note wishing her good luck in her difficulties. To me, that is unacceptable, as is the fact that family members of homosexuals are still taught that their loved ones are sinful. And homosexuals themselves are still raised believing that who they are is an abomination before God, and they continue to live lives filled with shame and self-loathing. These individuals give themselves no choice but to stick with the program, do the right thing, and enter into marriages that are pleasing in the sight of God. For a woman that doesn't know of her husband's sexual orientation until he comes out or is found out well into the marriage, although she may feel relieved to finally know the reasons for the problems in their sex life, communication, and relationship, the damage to her psyche is extensive. She too feels tricked, used, and betrayed. Regardless of whether she knew before or after marriage, when a straight woman learns her husband is gay, her entire world caves in. She feels rejected for her femininity, unwanted and undesired at the very deepest levels of who she is. Can this really be what a loving Heavenly Father wants for either one of them? I no longer believe so. So what about all those confirmations of the Spirit? If we felt the Spirit, it had to be ordained of God, right? I have learned that often what we thought was the Spirit sometimes is us believing something we just really want to believe, or hormones, or body chemistry, or imagination. One woman in our group wrote, "As human beings, it is so hard to distinguish between impressions of the Spirit and our own fears and fantasies. Add to that the fact that we all probably got into our relationships when we were young and inexperienced, plus all of us see life through the distorted lens of trauma, brain chemistry, family dysfunction, inexperience, etc. I am not saying this to diminish the responsibility we all have to choose wisely, but I truly do not think that anyone in this group is a stupid girl who was or is seeking pain and misery for herself and her children. Some of us were just fooled. But who were we fooled by? Our husbands? Do I feel like Stephen fooled me? Absolutely not. These gay men went in with just as much hope and faith as we did. Were we fooled by the church? Who is to blame? Is there even blame to be placed? Maybe responsibility is a better word. My parents were responsible for their choices. Stephen and I are responsible for our choices. We all do the best we can with what we have. The church is certainly responsible for its teachings, but bottom line, I chose to believe what I chose to believe. I made the choices I made. I allowed myself to blow with the wind. I chose not to think. Now it's time to forgive myself and move forward with my brain, my heart, and my whole self fully alive and intact. Although the solution seems very black and white to me, gay people happily marry gay people and straight people happily marry straight people, for those that still believe that God sees homosexuality as an abomination that is in direct opposition to his eternal plan for us, the solution is still a mixed orientation marriage. I am well aware of many, many young couples in the church today that are having a go at it. They believe that they will be the exception, and who am I to say they won't be? I remember very well when I felt that way. I can't speak for Stephen, but I know for me there was a huge spiritual payoff at the beginning. We were super saints. Not only were we being obedient and righteous, not only had we achieved a temple marriage, but my husband and I had gone above and beyond the call of duty. We had placed ourselves on the altar in a way that few ever did. We had sacrificed everything for God. Surely we would be rewarded for it. Back then, I never would have listened to someone that had wanted to discourage me any more than most of those young couples would listen to me today. And some of them just might be successful. But what is the measure of success? Enduring to the end? Living less of a life hoping for better in the next? Not for me. There are those couples in mixed marriages that will stand and swear that they are happy and fulfilled and would never trade what they have for anything, and I believe that they wouldn't. If it's really true, then they are the very rare exception. I refuse to invalidate another person's experience or beliefs just because they differ from my own, but I will say that I absolutely do not believe in reparative therapy or in the faith healing of homosexuality. What I do believe in with all my heart is a person's right to choose whatever life they feel is best for them, as long as it is truly what they choose, not because they are told it is a requirement. I've been asked if I could go back and change the fact that I had a gay dad, would I do so? Never in a million years. Except for the fact that having one gay parent pretty much means your parents will end up divorced. Having a parent that happens to be a homosexual is not necessarily a bad thing. What is hard is having a parent that happens to be a homosexual when you live in a homophobic and homoviolent society. Again, I'm asked if my marriage was a mistake. While I do wish that I would have chosen an easier way to deal with the massive unfinished business I had with my dad and to learn what I needed to learn, how on earth can I call something that healed some of my deepest wounds and created two of the finest people I have ever known a mistake? A world without my children is not a place I'm interested in living. Bottom line, if I had not chosen what I chose, I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't be who I am today. And I'm finally really liking that person a lot. Thank you. I'm supposed to introduce Annette Daly, who was born and raised in London, England, received certificates in advanced French and German from the University of London, lived in Germany for 7 years, and is fluent in French and German. She was named in the Who's Who of Executives and Professionals for 2004-2005. She loves reading, travel, volunteering, and is passionate about making a difference in the world. Currently, she serves on the board of the GLBT Center of Utah, and is a member of Equality Utah. She serves on the Activities Committee with Utah Women's Alliance for Building Community, and is a member of a WIC, American Women in Communications. She's a volunteer at the homeless shelter and has coordinated a team to volunteer at the Junior League Care Fair for the last several years. She is working on a biography tentatively entitled My Side of the Closet, Resurrecting Annette. Annette Daly. Daly?
Hello, good afternoon. This is weird. This feels like being back in the Mormon church, which I'm not in anymore. So if anybody out there knows my bishop, I don't care. I don't want to offend anybody, sorry. This is really interesting. It's been quite a journey for me, and to be able to share my experiences in the hope that it will help somebody else will be very good. So I used to be one of those people that thought that gay people could think themselves straight if they really wanted to. And I didn't think that because I believed it. I thought that because that's what I heard from the men in the Mormon church. I was married in the temple to a really incredible man. He is still one of my best friends and the father of my 4 wonderful sons. We were married 15 years and struggled through the typical and in retrospect not so typical aspects of a marriage. Many people initially, including my state president, I'm such a hardhead, said we shouldn't marry. I still am actually black and from England, and he's Caucasian. I promise I read this to myself to make sure it sounded okay. And he's Caucasian, he's from upstate New York, so we should theoretically have been polar opposites. But the tie that held us strongly together for that 15 years was deep-seated belief in the LDS church. So, we got married in Denmark because we lived in Europe at the time, in Germany, and residency requirements were a bit of a problem. So we went to Denmark in April, and because at that time you couldn't get married in the temple, you could only get sealed in the temple, we had the civil wedding in Denmark, and 2 days later went for the real wedding. So the night of our official honeymoon, it didn't happen. And the day after it didn't happen, and the day after it didn't happen, and finally on the third day, because I was... Even then, the person I am there, I said, you know what? This is going to happen tonight. There's just no no way around it. So years later, my former husband confided to me that after that experience, he went in the bathroom and threw up. I thought I was really fine about this, you know? But anyway... 6 weeks into the marriage, he was gone all night, did not come home, and I was frantic. So we called the military police and the German police and close friends, and were out scouring the streets, couldn't find him. Finally, the next morning, we found him in his office, and he was wearing workout wear and no garments, which was like the big rule. You have to wear them unless you're working out, but he wasn't working out, so he wasn't wearing them. And at the time, I just thought, it's kind of strange, but I actually never even had the guts to ask him where he went that night. But anyway, we talked about it, and he said, I've made a huge mistake. I can't be married. And me, still the same person that I am, hardcore and not a quitter, said, are you kidding? We're in this together. We promised in the temple before God and angels and witnesses and all that stuff that we're going to do this and we're going to be committed. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, and all those people, including the state president, said, don't do it. I'm not going to give them that satisfaction. So I said, let's go see the bishop, which, you know, sometimes can be a good thing and sometimes can't be a good thing. And the lay ministry is what it is. You get what you get. Sometimes you get someone that has an MSW, and sometimes you just get a guy that's doing the very best he can with what he has. Unfortunately for me, that began my love-hate relationship with LDS priesthood authorities who, I don't want to disrespect anybody. Good men just doing the best with what they can. My background is that I grew up in a really dysfunctional home with an alcoholic father and an abused mother. So where the hell was I going to learn how to be a good wife? I had no idea how to have a good relationship, much less an intimate relationship. I just knew that what we had in our marriage wasn't normal. Somehow, even though I hadn't seen a template, I just knew that something wasn't right. So I spent hours with the bishop, with the stake president, at LDS Social Services, on my knees, every book there was to read about being a good wife and catching a man and keeping a man and keeping him dressed in bed and spending money on underwear, not just that really cute woman underwear, and still nothing. Finally, a guy from LDS Social Services said to me one day, "Sister Daly, do you really think that your husband is that different than all the other men in the church?" And so then I'm thinking, okay, it's me. It's got to be me. He has the priesthood. He goes to church. He holds a calling. He's really great. He's done this, this, and this. He doesn't scream. He doesn't yell. He doesn't beat me. He provides a good living. So it's my problem. So I need to fix this. So 4 kids later, and quite a few years later, in fact, 1997, and we were expecting our 4th child. And that was a surprise to me because, we had sex once that year, and if you're a teenager out there, once is all it takes. and then it was just everything started to unravel. During the time I was pregnant, I discovered that my husband had been leading a double life, devoted and straight acting husband by day, and gay man who visited gay bars and chatted online and looked at gay porn at night. And how do I know that? Because I chatted with his online friends and saw the porn. And we were like quintessential. We didn't even see PG-13 movies. We didn't watch anything on Sunday unless it was the Disney Sunday movie. I mean, we were the couple. We thought we were the couple. It was bad. It was really bad. And it hit me really hard. I had this brand new baby and these kids that were doing their thing. And I was like, okay, what am I supposed to do? Where am I supposed to fit? And then I started looking back and thinking, I had a really close girlfriend, and she said, "Well, how did you not know? How could you not know?" And, I used to be a big fan of Oprah. Now I think she's just a little bit not what I thought she used to be, but she's just bigger than life, I suppose. But I remember her saying something about, you only see what you want to see because God, whoever, the creator, somebody prepares your mind to accept what you're able to accept. And I was not able to accept that this man who I loved was just not in love with me. It didn't matter. So bad. It was very bad. Okay, I've lost my place here. Excuse me. And my favorite part. Carolyn Pearson's book, Goodbye, I Love You. I had a friend that was living, I was living in Michigan at the time, and I had a friend in Utah, and I called all the bookstores and they're like, "Yeah, you can get it, it's on back order because it's not in print anymore, blah, blah, blah." So she sent me the book, and finally something made sense. And I thought, you know what? If one other person has been through it, then it's not just me. I'm not crazy. It was such an eye opener to read it. And then I asked him to move out. And people at church were saying, "You can't get separated, you have a new baby, you can't do this." And I'm thinking, when someone's been married 15 years and they have a new baby, they didn't just decide overnight they're getting divorced. So trust me when I tell you, we need to get divorced. And I didn't tell anybody why, it was nobody's bloody business. But then, people started to find out because, unbeknownst to me, one of his lovers actually came to the bishop and said, "Hey, that guy, I'm sleeping with him, and I think he's sleeping with his wife too because she's pregnant." But the bishop didn't think he should tell me. I understand confidentiality, but I think that that was really hard. That was really, really hard. So people were saying, "Well, don't speak to him, don't let him see the kids, cut off his penis." I mean, and I'm thinking, I've been in the temple with you people. We've been in the primary presidency together. We're friends. How can you not help me? And then I found PFLAG, Parents, Friends, anyway. I found that organization, and so I would go to church on Sunday, go to sacrament meeting with my kids, leave my kids with friends, and go to PFLAG meetings. And then I found people that could talk about this experience that I had. And it was very interesting because all the people that I thought were my friends were now all of a sudden like, ooh, we're going to catch it too. Yeah. And I, you know, I have perspective. It's been 10 years, 9 years actually, this month. If a person could think themselves out of being gay when they're married, bloody hell, they would think themselves out of being gay. If you could choose to be anything in this world, you probably wouldn't be a short, fat, black woman living in Utah. And you probably wouldn't choose to be gay. So as I said, it's been 9 years this month, and some of that pain is gone, and sometimes I can talk about it, and other times I'm just like, my gosh, it seems like it was yesterday. So, you know, it's just me, and it's not just Emily, and it's not just Doe. It's a lot of people, and it's real people, and it's real lives. According to a press release in May of last year, Valerie Larrabee, who's the executive director of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Center of Utah, she found this statistic. As far as men engaging in public lewdness, of the men who are arrested in Utah, 33% of them are married, and 57% of them are LDS. 57%. You know, I wish I didn't have to know the pain that comes from being the straight person in the gay marriage. But there's a price to pay. And I think at the end of the day, people should be able to live their lives according to the dictates of their own conscience. And some of you maybe recognize that. And my favorite, let them worship or live how, where they may. And we don't get to decide that. What I do know is that my former husband is one of the finest men I know. He is still ambiguously gay. He has a girlfriend and he has lovers. She doesn't know that. And my kids are like, Mom, maybe you should tell her. You know what? Not my story to tell. And even if I told her, yeah, what would that sound like? I mean, now we're starting to sound like Jerry Springer. I think there are so many good men who I know who struggle every day because they keep hearing, think yourself straight, go to Evergreen, go to a support group, go to counseling, just be a man. And it's not okay because somebody in that relationship is suffering. Somebody in that relationship is suffering, and I think that we just need to be open and honest with each other. I didn't know going into the marriage that my ex-husband was gay, and I wouldn't marry him again because there wasn't anything to hold it together. Somebody asked me one day, I think he's maybe bi, I'm not really sure, and he said, so do you think you could date somebody that was bisexual as long as you and he had a relationship and you knew that he was having relationships with other men? And I thought, you know, that wouldn't work for me because I know how I am and I know how I'm wired. And I think that people need to choose for themselves, but you have to be honest. So whether you choose to be in an openly gay relationship or you choose to be in a gay straight relationship, be honest. And Ben Christensen, I'm going to look you up in 10 years and see if that relationship works. I hope, are you out here? I'd really like to meet you. I think it's really great. Obviously, you really love your wife, but somebody is suffering there. It's not all great and rosy. And I think that we need to talk to people that have the power to make those decisions. Before 1978, my people weren't good enough for God. We were less than. We were lower than dogs, and we'd never be in heaven and never have the priesthood. And I can't even remember all the other stuff they said. And now it's those other people who happen to be gay people. I don't like the term same-sex attraction because it sanitizes it and it makes us think, oh, people could just stop acting on same-sex attraction like an alcoholic cannot drink if he's in a bar or something. I can no longer not be a straight person and pretend to be a gay person. I mean, I just am who I am, and we're wired the way we're wired. And my hope in doing my work that I do in the community is for all the straight people out there who love gay people on whatever level, whether you've been married to them, whether they're in your family, they're people in your life. They're teaching your kids. They're your counselors. They're your bishops. They're your brothers, your sisters. You need to speak out for them and help them too. Thanks so much for this opportunity. Our third and final panelist is Jo Daughtry. Is that good? Okay. Jo has an MA, is currently working towards a PhD in religious studies at ASU, where she teaches courses in American religion. Her main interest is in new and alternative religions in America, e.g. Mormonism, Soka, Gakkai, Wicca, especially issues relating to conversion, legitimacy, transmission of tradition, and religious music and book publishing. Her husband, David, owns a wealth management firm in Scottsdale, Arizona, and they hang out in Mesa with their 5 children, 4 grandchildren, Luna the Black Kitty, and Bubba the Fat Pug Dog.
And I really want to say something first that's really important to me. My husband is here, and he's here for the very first time, and I just want to publicly say how meaningful that is to me. I can't even express my gratitude for his coming. I love going last, because I get to benefit from what everybody else says. Everything that was said here, I really, one of the things that has struck me is that I feel like maybe there's an ideal type here or something, either an ideal type of experience, or because so much of what they said mirrored my experience, and so I feel like we've had it's like deja vu or something. Like Emily, I was one of those people who, I've often said and looked around Relief Society or Sacrament Meeting and thought, what is wrong with me? What was it about me that was this almost kind of fatal intersection between, I mean, I've come to realize that it was this intersection between my own psychology and how I heard things over the pulpit, how I experienced Mormonism has been, maybe I'm obsessive compulsive or something, I don't know, but I really just heard everything. I accepted it at face value, I believed it, I knew it, and so that made life, I'll never forget when we lived in New Jersey one time, hearing someone in the bishopric or stake presidency, we were going to do some humanitarian service together as a group. I can't remember well enough to tell you, David, when exactly this was, but somebody in the stake presidency or bishopric who was with us was talking about something, and I don't remember what it was. But I said, "Well, how can you believe that? The church doesn't teach that, or the church teaches that that's not true." And he said, "Well, I just, you know, take what works for me, and I'll just let the rest go." And I'm like, damn. I never could do that, you know. And so that made life very, very painful for me. So that's just. I joined the church in 1972 when I was 16. I was a very lonely, only child who was attracted to the ways in which family was enacted in the church, especially as I was able to hear myself referred to as sister, and to refer and to actually feel joined to others in familial terms, and ultimately to be joined forever with an eternal mate. Unfortunately, I also adopted the urgency to marry again. I heard it, and I was like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. I need to go do it. And to have children from my experience at BYU, and I began, like so many other women of my generation, to feel like a frightened, unmarried failure by the age of 20. After leaving BYU for home in the University of Houston in 1975, and I was a mess, I met and married a young man whose family was well known in the church in Houston. We married in the temple in 1978 and immediately had 2 children. In 1980, when our second child was 2 months old, I discovered that my husband was having an affair with a single male friend who had sat in my kitchen, and we'd gone to movies together and laughed and played together. I was devastated, but I was not, at that point at least, entirely shocked. It had been obvious to me from the very first day. I had a similar honeymoon experience. That he was less than satisfied with the physical aspects of our marriage, and his resentment only increased as time went on. But for quite some time, he had also been wearing makeup, which he attributed to a requirement of the modeling career he'd been pursuing, and nail polish. I was actually the one who confronted him with the question of whether or not he was gay, and his response included the declaration that his love interest wanted him to leave us and move in with him. That week, soon after, I went to my bishop, explained the situation, emphasizing that my husband no longer wanted to be married to me, and I told him I was planning on divorcing and I needed his help. But his response shocked me. I actually remember, and this is a big deal because I don't have much of a memory, I'm the family joke, I actually remember his exact words. The brethren won't cancel your temple ceiling. That's not adultery. If he is homosexual, it's your fault, and you need to go home and make yourself available to him. And unfortunately, my ex-husband, although I want to be very respectful of him, he was not a happy person, and he really did take it out on me. So I was pretty well beat down by the time, not physically, but emotionally, pretty rock bottom by the time I went to my bishop. And so I had neither the emotional stamina nor physical reserves to even think of, I would never have even thought to go to the state. I've had people say, why didn't you just go to the state president? That's stupid. You know? Well, you know, you have to think that's an option first, and that never even occurred to me. During the next year, we moved to another area of Salt Lake and into a new ward, and as it turns out, my husband's home teaching companion, a husband and father of five, was also gay. Unlike us, his wife had known from the beginning that she was marrying a gay man, but had prayed and had personal witness, again, that the Lord wanted her to marry him. He had been unfaithful to her multiple times, and though I assumed it was mutual, her long-suffering agony seemed to be the example I was supposed to follow. I mean, in fact, I assumed ward leaders had teamed the two men purposefully so that they could be some sort of example to my husband and I. In any case, it wasn't until almost a year after that, during conference weekend in April, that I decided I could no longer live as I was. And it wasn't because I just got fed up. It was because over the course of that week, I came to know that my husband had actually been lying to me about the extent of the relationship that he'd had the year before, and a new bishop who was sympathetic and less cynical of my position in relation to my temple ceiling. More importantly, perhaps, he declined to identify me as some sort of perpetrator against my husband and helped me pack my bags to leave him. I left Utah for Texas to live with my parents, obtained a divorce, and met and married and was sealed to my current wonderful husband just about a year after I left my first husband behind. That's the story as briefly as I can tell it. Of course, that doesn't have much emotion in it. But that's just it in a nutshell. The nuances, of course, are in the details and in the questions Holly poses for this panel discussion. For most people who hear it, this is a tragic story. It was a tragedy for me, my husband, and for my children. It became a different kind of tragedy for my new husband and the family we built together because every aspect of our lives has been tainted, touched. I wrote touched and then tainted came out. I'm just so sensitive now to the ways in which that trauma affected my current marriage and my children's lives. This would be true regardless of our religious affiliation or lack of. However, LDS attitudes about marriage, family, priesthood, and the roles of women, as Holly puts it in the abstract, combined with my own personality idiosyncrasies to compound and exacerbate the tragedy. For the purposes of telling the rest of the story, I've divided these issues into the categories of doctrine, theology, and practice. And sometimes it's a little difficult to tell the difference between the categories, and sometimes their boundaries are obviously blurred. But at the heart of this tragedy is the seemingly foundational doctrine of the importance of an eternal nature of marriage in Mormonism. Alone, LDS concepts of marriage are expansive and engender commitment and visions of eternal creativity. That's how I certainly still see it. At the time, however, the church's 1970s and to 1980s cultural practices derived from theological interpretations, conveyed romantic, simplistic, and idealistic views of marriage to children and youth, while simultaneously pressing teens to marry in the temple and have families before becoming fully aware adults, including the insistence that marrying in the temple was more important than social or emotional compatibility, and that those marriages were irrevocable. Similarly, the doctrine of lay male priesthood has several advantages over other leadership systems, and its enactment is to some extent egalitarian in nature, or at least fosters egalitarian leadership opportunities and relationships. I mean, anyone might become the Relief Society president. Anyone might become the bishopric, or next week they may be working in the primary. However, as noted by others much more articulate than me, this poses two problems. First, I found it extremely difficult to discuss the intimate problems specific to my experience of marriage and sexuality with my ex-husband, with my bishop, a man I hardly knew. I was intimidated, frightened, and demoralized by his response, and therefore unwilling, actually unable, to press him with my concerns or advocate for myself or my children. Similarly, I was virtually unable to make decisions in my own best interest because I had so completely internalized the admonitions conveyed over the pulpit by general authorities and then reinforced by local leaders, the circular theological reasoning that rejecting the bishop's counsel or going above his head for redress was equivalent to rejecting the Lord and thereby jeopardized my eternal salvation. I had people tell me that. Second, for all its benefits, I was married to a gay man because lay priesthood in the LDS context is non-professional. Trained only in the Mormon theological explanations for homosexuality, the bishop and stake president who allowed us to marry knowing my groom was gay did so out of the ill-conceived theologically driven notion that marriage would cure him. The tragedy was compounded by the insular prescription expounded by general church leadership against seeking outside help. At the time, they did prescribe seeking outside help for psychological problems, which these non-professionals, suspicious of psychology, interpreted as primarily spiritual problems. So they didn't interpret it as a psychological problem, but as a spiritual problem. For all intents and purposes then, instead of the counseling I would have gotten today, had this been my experience, my untrained in marriage counseling bishop commanded me to go home, make myself sexually available, and pray and read more scriptures as a solution to my problem. Finally, the concept of eternal marriage is what I would consider to be one of the most important and beautiful Mormon doctrines. How it gets worked out on the ground, however, is a practice that grows out of theological interpretation. Sealing is a practice which is currently interpreted in the following way. A woman may be sealed to only one man, while a man may be sealed to multiple women, though today not at the same time. This means, then, that women who are widowed or divorced are forced to apply for a cancellation of their sealing if they want to be sealed to another eternal partner. Though I understand that the church has made certain changes to try to even out this inequity, the fact remains that men do not face the same problems as women do with regard to their potential for temple remarriage. Because I have taught both in young women's and had daughters in this program as recently as 3 years ago, I taught longer ago than, less recently than 3 years ago, but we have, our youngest daughter was in young women as recently as 3 years ago. I know that young LDS men and women are still socialized to marry only in the temple. Imagine what it was like for me in 1981 when I faced the pariah-like identity of being non-marriageable in a community that divides heavens up, not by love and commitment, but by ordinance. Regardless of what actually happens on the ground, Mormon theology insists that following the prophet means that no good LDS man would want to marry someone he could not take to the temple. Even though I think I expressed it as well as I could, given that I was also criticized for and therefore feared publicly expressing anger or frustration over my situation, and I was still suffering from my experience as well, my current husband may not really even know the depth of my fear that no one, including him, would ever want me and that I was permanently tainted. In addition to these institutional issues, I face the theological interpretations of sealing of those who were supposedly called by God to advise me, the home teacher, for instance, who insisted that my husband's repentance precluded me from cancellation of sealing, because, you know, if he's repented, then he didn't really, it's like it never happened, so you can't apply for, there's nothing to apply for. The bishop who insisted my husband's behavior didn't constitute a legitimate reason for granting such a request. And then there were others who had vested interests, such as the argument made by various members of my husband's family that I could never leave him because my temple covenants meant I'd promised to be with him forever. And other incredibly thoughtless comments by acquaintances, such as, if you get your sealing canceled you don't remarry, then when you die, your children will go to him. The actual process of petitioning for a cancellation of sealing at the highest level of church leadership was one of the most humiliating and demoralizing experiences I have ever had. Having been told by virtually everyone that the chances weren't good, or that certainly the outcome was unknowable, that obtaining a cancellation was extremely difficult, I had to write a letter to then-President Kimball, a complete stranger to me, telling him of all the intimate details of my marriage, a letter that I never let anyone read, things I hadn't told anyone because of how humiliating they were to me, so as to try to convince him that my situation was worthy of such a special dispensation, that I was worthy of being sealed to the man I wanted to then marry. Finally, though it is not yet canonized, I think we are assured that with President Hinckley's death, the family proclamation will be presented to the church membership as a formal revelation and added to our quads as an insert. The proclamation effectively serves as a doctrine on the nature of personhood. It asserts that gender is eternal, thus framing theological interpretation and cultural attitudes about gayness. The very fact that the church rhetorically frames the topic as same-sex attraction minimizes its implications for wives, children, mothers, fathers, etc. Though not alone in its ignorance, the 1980s LDS community was not only poorly informed, but arrogant in its ignorance. I was so traumatized by my experience, the marriage itself, and my community's response to it, that I became angry, fearful, even more so than usual, and virulently homophobic. And thus I blame my suffering on my ex-husband's homosexuality. It took me several years to recover and to realize that many of the problems I faced in my marriage actually derived not from the fact that he was gay, but from other pathological idiosyncrasies of personality, both his and mine. Not all gay men reject their wives and children, nor do they so envy and therefore so grow to hate their partners as he did me. So I thought I understood how things really were, and I forgave and had compassion for his responses to the impossible situation into which he'd been pressured. However, it wasn't until recently that when I took myself alone to see Brokeback Mountain, I came to a new level of understanding and compassion. The movie conveyed something I could never have otherwise experienced: marriage to someone he wanted to love, but who never had access to the inner agony of his own inner life. I left the theater humbled and repentant. And as I said, my husband David is here in the audience, his first time to see me present a paper in his first Sunstone session. He's a saint, mainly because he married me, but also because he did so when his family had hope for so much more than a divorced woman with two children. Because of the emotional trauma of my first marriage, it took me 10 years to believe him when he said he would never leave me. He's so honored my progressive untangling from simplistic Mormon theological notions and their practical concomitants that have either explicitly harmed me or that are not congruent with my expanded, more rational, thoughtful understandings of the way the world really works. I respect him deeply for his commitment to me and to the church, and for his love for the children he adopted. I'm also grateful that my ex-husband has found a partner with whom he is happy. I only wish he could have developed a healthy relationship with the daughters our marriage produced. He became more interested in a relationship with them, I think, when he found his partner, which is not unusual, no surprise there, and when they began marrying and having children of their own. But this is another topic altogether, that of what happens when a parent, gay or not, comes to decide, perhaps too late, that a gift once rejected is of incomparable value. I've been told many times over the years not to kick against the pricks, and I've been asked why I can't just let this go. Though I once retorted back that I was waiting for the church to say it was sorry, that I needed an apology, for the most part I have forgiven. I don't think about this all the time. However, forgiving isn't necessarily about forgetting. I have forgotten how painful it was until I guess I start doing this. However, it isn't so much about forgetting or forgiveness even, but about how an event or an experience shapes us. We are different people because of these experiences. We can't be anybody else or any way else. the ways in which I was shaped for good or for ill by my first marriage, and the impact on my experience of what were then current institutional doctrines, theologies, and practices, and their cultural interpretations are undeniable. I have no way of knowing who I would have been otherwise, so it's really irrelevant to speculate.
I want to thank all my panelists. I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Dan Witherspoon, who has let me do just some of the wackiest panels. And I could go on, but you've heard enough from me. I'm going to exercise some of my privileges as the chair. Troy, do you want to say anything? This is Troy. If you don't know Troy, I
just want to say that I'm so glad I'm gay, and I'm so glad you got married.
I'm friends with all these women up on the panel right here, and Emily I just met last week, and I interviewed her on my radio show, and I love them so much. But I want everyone to know that, you know, and I want to take issue with you just briefly, Annette. Yeah. I always tell people I would choose to be gay because it's so damn great to be gay. All right? It's a wonderful life. And I want every gay person out there to know how beautiful that is so that you guys don't walk into these scenarios over and over and over again. Believe that you're beautiful. Believe that you're here for a purpose, that God wants you here to raise consciousness, to expand our capacity to love each other. And you women out there, believe in your own divine worth. Isn't that something really, isn't that the little virgin on a chain, isn't that something to deal with that? The divine worth. Women, you deserve better than to marry a man who does not sexually desire you, all right? Take that message back to your church. For those of you who are still active, take this message back to your congregations. Gay people are great. They're here for you. And women are even greater, all right? And someone once asked me, Troy, how did you get to be so progressive? How did you get to be so liberal and so open? And I said it without even thinking. It's because of the women in my life that made me open up my eyes. So thank you, all four of you, very much.
I really wanted Troy. Troy said that to me the other night about how he would choose to be gay. And, you know, I don't care why people are gay. I don't care if it's inborn. I don't care if it's an experimentation. I don't care if they choose it. I don't see what's wrong with it. And I want it to be okay, and I want us to support it. We have very little time left. I'm done now. But we have 5 minutes left, so if you have comments, questions, please come up.
I'm a little too short for this microphone. Is that working? My name is Carrie Williams. I was married to a gay man for 10 years. He was bishop for 5, and about 6 months after his release, came out to me. And since that time, I have come to know other women, as we tend to do, kind of try to find each other. And I've heard your experiences, and they resonate a lot with me, not just because of my marriage, but because of my experience with the filter of the church, that everything comes to you and you think you have to do everything right. But my question is that I hear, you know, these horrible things that have been said by individual bishops to women about how it's their fault or how they're not sexy enough or whatever, and it seems like it's archaic. Your experience was in the early 80s, but since I've found other women like me, I know that it's still happening, that bishops are still giving this sort of advice, and I wonder if, A, you think women who have been in this situation, who aren't necessarily still in the church or maybe are, have a moral obligation to take action to inform other women who may find themselves in the situation that the advice that they're getting is not necessarily true? And if so, what is that action? I mean, I think this is pretty much the choir here. And how do we preach to those who are not here?
Well, I don't know if this is an answer to the question, but at least this is what came to my mind. When did we go to BYU? In 1987, so I left my husband. So in 1987, I was married and had two more children, and my husband came to BYU to get his MBA. And we were living with his sister and her husband, and I picked up an old, is it Daily Universe, the student campus newspaper? And I never did that. An old one anyway. I'd never, for what any no reason to pick up an old one, and was just looking through it, and there was an ad that someone who was getting her MSW was for her project, for her dissertation, or thesis, was doing a study on ex-spouses of homosexual men. That's the way she framed it. And so she was advertising for respondents, basically, for informants. And so I responded to that, and out of that came a support group that I thought I was alone. I mean, I really thought no one else knows what this feels like. And so this was in that year then, we had one of the very first meetings that we had. She formed a support group, and they had invited, she invited a man from Salt Lake who the church had hired out of Dallas, I believe he said. He was a psychologist, and this apparently, according to him, was the first real move the church had made to try to deal with this problem. And he told us, he said, you are not alone. We could fill a football stadium with you. And I said, well, why did it take them so long to try to help, to want to help us, or to want to do anything? And he said, it wasn't until one of the general, until this knocked on the door of a general authority, and it visited their house, that they felt any urgency to do anything. Oh, I don't know. I don't know. It was the daughter, I think, had married, and I don't know, he didn't say who it was, but apparently one of the general authority's daughter had married a gay man or something. And so, I mean, what I thought of in answer to your question, what I thought of is that really perhaps we should be writing to the general authorities. I mean, if you know that, I mean, I really thought things had changed, but if you know that this has not changed, then we need to be writing the general authorities and saying, we need to be writing to the church and saying, this experience is still happening, you know, that this travesty is still happening, and it may or may not work or have any effect. But support groups are good too. I think we should, I mean, the website, the group that you've started is, I think, the greatest.
I'm Stephen Fales, and I had the honor of being married to Emily. And Emily, that was so well said. And I'm really grateful that you have Ren in your life. And to quote from my play, Emily, two in the morning. Emily was not responsible for my homosexuality. She deserved to have a man ravish her in the bedroom to celebrate her femininity the way only a straight man can. She deserved her life back and to smile again. And could she please forgive me for cheating on her? Because I wanted to be your friend. Thank you, Emily, for your kind words to me.
My name is Laura Bush, and I'm privileged to know at least a couple of these women, and very grateful for what you've shared. And I think that there is other action to be taken. I think this is one of the most brilliant panels I've been to at Sunstone. There have been very good things. But to me, this is a really timely topic, and we should take advantage, and we should ask these women to find other kinds of publications. I think writing general authorities only goes so far. I think you have to get, well, no. Well, this is a grassroots kind of thing, and I think that I just went to Carolyn's Circling the Wagons. I think that Carolyn has things to suggest to us, but that we should not allow the momentum of this to go away, and that the things that you've written today, I want you to know they've motivated, inspired, they've touched us all, and they need to be published wider, and I don't know what that form will look like if you already have internet publications, but other kinds of publications. There are women who need this. There are men who need this information. The community needs it at many different levels, and you have something very dear to offer to people: comfort, inspiration, direction, solutions. And I think we should make sure that this energy doesn't stop here. So thank you for this.
We've run over time by a few minutes, but thank you again all so very much for coming, and enjoy the rest of Sunstone.